Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, Belgium is rocked by apparent terrorist attacks. We'll hear what is being said on social media about the bombings. A rider on the Brussels train system shares his story.
The conductor stopped the train pretty abruptly, opened the doors, and told everyone to get out.
And the U.S. president addresses the Cuban people. It's right here on the Voice of America. Three explosions rocked Brussels today. Two were at the airport and one at a metro station in the heart of the Belgian capital. VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez joins us on the line. Welcome, Luis.
Hi, Susan.
What do you know about these explosions?
Well, we're learning more details as the day goes on. Of course, the death toll continues to rise. The first that we know about the explosions is that coming from Belgium's foreign prosecutor, who said that it was probably a suicide bomb. The second is that the authorities are now investigating whether the second bomb was contained in a piece of baggage at the departures area of Brussels International Airport. The whole area has been sealed off, the evacuation pretty much completed, but there is no one can get anywhere near it, the airport right now. And as far as the one at the metro station, still very much under investigation. The whole system has been shut down, transit ground to a halt across Brussels.
And Brussels is a key city in Europe.
It's considered the heart of Europe. It is, of course, the headquarters of both NATO and the European Union. It's considered the center of all things pan-European. And so this, as the president of France pointed out earlier, is seen as an attack not just on Belgium, not just on Brussels, but at Europe as a whole. This is also raising very big questions as to why Belgian officials had not secured the city more than they did. Analysts are pointing out that we're talking about a country that is smaller than France, certainly has less capabilities in terms of security than the United States. But one of the major questions that's being asked right now going forward is how can nations like Britain and France help Belgium boost its security and thus boost the security of Europe in general.
These blasts have resulted in the closure of many means of transportation in the area.
Through much of Tuesday, all rail links going into Brussels have been cut off. That certainly includes the Eurostar trains that regularly run between Paris and Brussels, London and Brussels. The airport does remain closed. And so there are also a number of checkpoints set up where travelers are reporting that at this moment it is virtually impossible to enter Brussels. The borders have been secured. That was the announcement earlier from the Belgian Prime Minister, who said extra police were being deployed. That was a similar announcement made in France by France's president, who said 1,600 extra police and military are being deployed to the borders, to the airports, to further secure them.
Well, thank you very much, Luis.
Thank you, Susan.
Our national security correspondent, Jeff Selden, joins me here at the Anchor Desk. He's been looking into the context of the Belgium bombings today. Welcome, Jeff, as always.
Glad to be here. Glad to help out.
So what is your take on all this after studying it?
Well, having talked to various intelligence officials, to European sources, diplomatic sources, the one thing that comes across is that as terrible as the attacks are, it's not a surprise. One Western diplomatic source told me that, quote, we have to get used to it. We've been through this twice in the past year already. And so there's a sense of foreboding. There's a sense that there's this is going to be something that's going to be a long fight in terms of rooting out these terror cells, especially in Belgium, where, as you heard Luis talk about, how there's this concentration. When you talk about the European foreign fighters and those attracted to the ideology of the Islamic State terror group, the per capita, the number coming from Belgium has been a huge concern. It was where the Paris attacks were planned. It's where they just had the raids last week that captured the one of the tacticians and one of the only surviving member of the group, the cell that pulled off the Paris terror attacks. And the other thing officials are saying is that it's something that's likely going to be repeated. This attack so far, while there are claims, and Islamic State has claimed responsibility, it said that its people opened fire in the airport before detonating their vests.
We didn't have that report of fires.
This is from the claim that the Islamic State has put out. They've put out claims now in English, in French, and in Arabic. And according to these claims, intelligence officials are looking at them right now, although these are sources from which these claims are usually reliable. They're saying that the people in the airport, they didn't give a number of people, but they said their fighters who went to the airport opened fire with guns. That would be consistent with what we saw with the Paris attacks, where there was gunfire before the use of the explosive vest, the suicide bombers. And they're saying, they claim to, I think, according to their account, and again, they'd be prone to exaggeration, but they said over 230 people killed or injured. So you have that claim that came pretty quickly. It could indicate one of two things, that this is something that was long planned, perhaps, and we don't know this for sure, but it could be an indication that there was some coordination with Islamic State core in Raqqa, Syria, or Mosul in Iraq, or it could be just an indication that this terror cell, according to analysts, was a very sophisticated terror cell and didn't need much in order to carry out. It didn't need a lot of direction from Islamic State leaders to carry out this type of operation, which, again, would also be a grave concern.
So you would say this isn't a copy of the Paris attack, but it is certainly similar.
It's not what intelligence officials, analysts are saying. It's not as complex an attack to pull off, but it is along the same models, hitting soft targets, even in airports. Some officials have noted that tends to be a harder target, a more al-Qaeda-like target for a terrorist attack. But where do they hit? At the ticketing counter before security. That's a soft target, very much a hallmark of what the Islamic State tries to do.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for stopping by and sharing with us.
Glad to help.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists was able to find hundreds of nearby galaxies that had been hidden by the dust and stars of the Milky Way. This gave them some new insight into a mysterious astronomical anomaly some 150 million light years away. Writing in a new study, the group says a third of the 883 galaxies they found behind our home galaxy have never been seen before. The study's lead author, Lister Stavely Smith, from the University of Western Australia, said that while the Milky Way itself is very beautiful and interesting, it completely blocks out the view of the more distant galaxies behind it. The scientists say their discovery may also help explain a phenomena called the Great Attractor, which is described as a region of space that seems to be pulling ours and hundreds of thousands of other galaxies toward it with a gravitational force that's tens of thousands of times more powerful than that of the entire Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Sejan Gohel is International Security Director at the Asia-Pacific Foundation in London. He tells International Edition Sarah Williams the Brussels bombings are a response to last week's arrest of Paris attack suspect Sahal Abdeslam.
I strongly believe that this terrorist attack in Brussels is directly connected to the arrest and apprehension of Abdeslam. We were wondering how ISIS would react to it, and tragically, we got their response with deadly effect. It seems that they want to capture the headlines, keep the focus on them, and control the narrative.
What implication does this have, not just for Brussels itself, but for other major cities in Europe, such as London?
This raises enormous security concerns at major transportation hubs, because in all European cities and also those in the United States, there is no restrictions on who can go into the departure lounges of airports. They may have security personnel there, but there aren't machines scanning people to come in. Family members are not banned from it. Some countries in the Middle East and Asia have had to bring in those restrictions over the last two decades because of terrorist problems. Now, this raises the very unpalatable prospect that we may have to make transportation security even more irksome and cumbersome than it already is.
Because one of these bombings occurred not just at the airport, but also in the city's metro. And I know that's a concern the world over about, because it's a soft target.
They planned this very well, the plotters, because they targeted both an airport and also a railway station, two key arteries to Brussels' transportation infrastructure, were severed today. And it illustrates that they have the personnel, the will, the resources, and the determination to do this. And what's happened right now is not a one-off event. It is part of a series of plots that ISIS has been conducting. And we must not be so naive as to assume that it can't happen again. The thing that worries me the most is just how many potential supporters there are in Belgium for ISIS. It seems that Belgium has become their logistical headquarters in Europe.
Well, certainly we've heard a lot about that Molenbeek area, but perhaps there are other parts of the country as well.
Molenbeek is a suburb in Brussels, and that has very much been the epicenter for recruitment for people from Belgium to join ISIS. But there are other parts of the city and also wider in the country which have had recruitment for ISIS. And it is an unfortunate fact that Belgium has contributed one of the highest number of foreign fighters in Europe to ISIS. So this is something that the country is going to have to look at internally. It does not have the security apparatus that, say, France or Germany has. It's on a much smaller scale. But they are facing a threat that is very significant.
This story has been trending a lot today on the web, and joining me with details is our social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
And what have you been finding on the internet on this?
Well, there are a lot of remarkable similarities to this Belgian attack and the attack in Paris, France, back in November, as far as social media is concerned. Back in November, we saw hashtag Pray for Paris, hashtag Je suis Paris. Now we're seeing hashtag Je suis Brussels, Pray for Brussels, Pray for Belgium. We're also seeing, back in November, we saw people changing their Facebook profile pictures and putting a filter over it of the French flag. We're seeing people do that now with the Belgian flag, the black, yellow, and red. So instructions are quickly spreading online for people to do that. So I expect to see in the coming hours and days a lot of those filters being applied over people's profile pictures as a show of solidarity.
And when this violence occurred, people immediately were taking photos and tweeting and all that.
Some of the first photos and videos that were coming out that were being displayed by news organizations were coming from people just traveling along, whether it was on the metro or through the airport. There was one short video I saw of someone immediately in the aftermath. It had to have been not more than 30 seconds after this bomb had gone off, and they took out their cell phone and started filming. And you can see people running. You can see the smoke still rising. So you get a lot more immediate coverage than you ever would with a news person being on the scene. In fact, it took some of the reporters, you know, a couple of hours to get to the scene, as opposed to these people who were living it right there. And it really gives you a different perspective.
And you were mentioning to me that some of these modes of social media have actually adapted to help people communicate.
Exactly. The Facebook check-in is probably the chief example of this. What Facebook does is, for people who are in an area affected by either a natural disaster or, in this case, a terrorist attack, they turn on this check-in feature, and it allows people, when they go onto Facebook, to click a button and say, yes, I was in the area where this happened, but yes, I'm okay. And this is an invaluable tool for a lot of people, especially when cell phone lines are down and other means of communication are maybe severed. If they still have internet access, they can still get to Facebook, and they can alert a wide number of people. Rather than calling people individually, they can go on Facebook and alert all their friends and family.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, President Obama continues his historic visit to Cuba, and we hear from a passenger on the Brussels train system. President Obama has addressed the Cuban people on the last day of his historic visit to that nation. Joining us on the line from Florida after returning from Cuba is reporter Raymond Taylor. Hi, Raymond.
Hi, Susan.
So what did the president have to say today?
Well, it's important to note that this was much more of, I think, a somber reaction with the aftermath of what happened in Belgium just now, he began his remarks giving his condolences and in spreading a message of unity. And that's sort of how he transitioned his message, which I believe would have been very similar either way. It was very much a message of unity, again, in fighting against terrorism at the beginning, but then in telling the Cuban people. And in this speech in particular, he really reached out and probably used more Spanish in this speech than he ever has in any previous speech before to the American people or elsewhere. He mentioned that they have a lot of commonalities. They've come a long way in their history since the Cold War, and specifically said that he came here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas, and that was a very significant moment. It's important to note, though, that he did mention some of the big differences that the two countries still share today, particularly mentioning the arbitrary detentions we saw this past weekend with the Ladies in White. Again, one of the most renowned dissident groups that were detained this weekend. This is something that has been very, I suppose, closely watched in terms of civil society sort of watching how Obama would react to this and whether this was going to bring a sense of unity among those that have very different opinions of what the future direction in Cuba should be.
This was a very significant address for a U.S. president to make.
It was this bury the hatchet again, as he said, after 88 years of something that was completely unprecedented. And then, you know, he made note of the fact that American society wouldn't be here today. It wouldn't be what it is today. You know, in the 50s and the 60s, you wouldn't imagine two Cuban national Republicans running against a woman and a democratic socialist in this presidential election. So again, it starts with Obama, but it will continue afterwards. And he mentioned the role of the youth in building bridges among the Cuban people and in listening to the young people in Miami. Here where I am today in Florida, there's a much different outlook that is sort of building optimism in terms of the future direction of Cuba, while still holding truth to the fact that there are many challenges still ahead. With freedoms of expression and the ability to do business and elect a president democratically.
Well, thank you very much, Ramon.
Thank you so much, Susan.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
The fishing industry in Mauritania accounts for up to 10% of its gross domestic product. But local fisherman Baro Diop worries his livelihood is in danger.
There are big boats that stop here coming from the sea, big trawlers that destroy the seagrass. And the seagrass these trawlers destroy is where the fish live.
A new global initiative, though, aims to push for more sustainable fishing practices and keep track of the world's fish stocks. Jacqueline Alder is with the Food and Agriculture Organization.
The Fishing Transparency Initiative will help to improve governance by looking at who has the right to fish, how much it costs to fish, and how much they catch.
According to the Fishing Transparency Initiative, overfishing is threatening much the world's fish stocks. Once governments sign on to the voluntary initiative, as Mauritania has done, they must adhere to guidelines for gathering and disclosing information about their fishing industries. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
Stephen Dow, an American author who is currently living in Brussels, was riding two trains behind the train that had the bomb on it today, and he now joins us on the phone. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, this must have been an upsetting... tell us your story. What happened?
It was. I was actually running late this morning on my way into the center of Brussels, and I got on the train, and we went one stop. I got on at the Petion station, went one stop, and then the conductor stopped the train pretty abruptly, opened the doors, and told everyone to get out. He said we were supposed to get out of the train and leave the station immediately. And I asked him on the way out what had happened, and he said there had been an incident in a train, you know, two trains in front. But he looked really shaken. He didn't really want to give any more information than that.
Were people orderly when they got off of your train?
Yeah, completely. There was no panic. There was it was a very orderly situation. People were tense, And they were certainly aware of their surroundings to a degree that they thought were anomaly, but there was no panic at all.
Were people getting on their phones?
They were completely. Everyone was on their phone, as a matter of fact, or either calling presumably loved ones or their offices, or just checking to find out what had been going on. We didn't really find out what had happened until probably 15 or 20 minutes later.
How did you find out?
I got a phone call from my wife, and then the people on the I switched from the metro to a tram, and the people on the tram were talking about it as well. So
I'm sure your wife was very relieved to hear your voice.
She was. She was, yeah. I think everyone, as far as I know, everyone I know here is accounted for and safe. And I don't know of anyone who's lost anyone, so we're all very happy about that.
Had you sensed that there was tension in the air leading up to today? Was there any signs that something awful was going to happen?
You know, we've had troops on the streets here since the Paris bombings, and you never entirely get used to seeing them. But I think a lot of us thought this was maybe a bit of an overreaction to the Paris bombings. And in truth, there's not a lot that troops on the streets are going to be able to do when someone wants to go in and blow themselves up. There's been a little bit of tension, but it hasn't been particularly pronounced. And even this morning, after people found out what had happened at the airport, it was people were aware, as I said, but it was calm. There isn't the sense of panic or anything like that.
Do you believe that the government's been doing all it can to help protect people from incidents like this?
Oh, I do. Yeah, absolutely. I think, as I say, they've had troops on the streets for months. They have been very communicative about what's happening, what's going on. You know, if anything, they've erred on the side of being overcautious.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Well, again, thank you for having me.
We would like to invite you all to visit us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Safe drinking water is fundamental to healthy lives and prosperous communities. To focus attention on the importance of clean water and to advocate for the sustainable management of freshwater resources, on March 22nd of every year, we observe International World Water Day. Every person needs at least 20 liters of water per day for drinking, cooking, sanitation, and hygiene needs alone. Yet some 2 billion people worldwide do not have access to safe drinking water, and more than 2.4 billion people do not have access to improved sanitation for adequate disposal of human waste. People who do not have access to clean water and sanitation are at greatly increased risk of infectious diseases, which can lead to physical and cognitive impairments and premature death. Contaminated water and poor sanitation are among the main causes of severe diarrheal diseases in the very young, the second leading cause of death in children under 5 years old. According to the World Health Organization, or WHO, some 760,000 young children die of diarrheal diseases across the world every year. It is further estimated that as few as 5 incidences of diarrhea in children under the age of 2 can lead to lifelong effects, such as developmental delays and stunting. Clearly, an adequate supply of safe water and access to basic sanitation are the most basic necessities of life. But the importance of clean water goes so much further than the assurance of hydration and cleanliness. This year's theme for the United Nations World Water Day is Better Water, Better Jobs. The slogan is meant to bring attention to the fact that nearly all jobs, regardless of the sector, depend directly on water. Cleaner water makes for a safer, more productive environment, results in healthier food, and contributes to a greener economy and sustainable development. But ensuring that people everywhere have access to all the clean water they need, where they need it, when they need it, reliably and sustainably, requires global cooperation. On this World Water Day, the United States remains steadfast in our commitment to achieving a water-secure future, and we invite all stakeholders to partner with us to save water and save lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.